So, good morning again. Good afternoon now. It's hotter than it was when we met outside. Things change, as we said, everything passes. Things change even the rituals that we do here. So, we've only recently introduced this chant before the Dharma talk again. So some of you who haven't been here for a while were not familiar with it, and I guess we don't have sutra books everywhere, so follow along as you did. And introducing that chant is a way of structuring. We know that when we sit down and someone sits here and we say it's a Dharma talk, we announce it's a Dharma talk, we're prepared then for that. And the chant is a way of introducing a different kind of structure to point ourselves to. It's rare. These teachings are rarely encountered and subtle, infinitely subtle. Of course, when we say they're rarely encountered, it's not that they're not there, it's that we don't see them, it's that we don't hear them. That is a teaching there. That's the Dharma talk out there, but we don't see it that way. And so this is a way of bringing our attention, focusing our attention with that chant. At some point I may drop it again, I don't know. We'll see. I introduced it not so long ago just to see what would happen. And as I mentioned last night, this is our daily life. We think of it as something else, and it is something else. The structure is different, the activities are different, but it's our daily life too. And I thought of a story from the great layperson who is very inspiring, from the 9th century in China, Layman Pang, who was inspiring because he was not a monastic. This practice that the way that we do it is inspired by monastic practice. We can say we're developing in a monastic formation, although we're all lay people and we're meeting the teachings through this monastic structure, and yet we're also meeting them out there. So can we use the monastic structure to help us to encounter them out there, rather than thinking that we can only encounter it in the monastic structure, let's say, something like that. And Layman Pang is very inspiring for that, because he and his family, he was a businessman, and he and his family wandered around from some of the greatest teachers of the Zen tradition, visited them, and studied with them, listened to their talks, exchanged with them, and yet remained lay people. At one point, it's not clear, I've told this story before, it's not clear if it was intentional or not, but they were on a boat in the river, and the boat sank. And all of their possessions were on the boat. And all of the wealth that, whatever they had accumulated, was on that boat, and they lost it all. Some versions say that it was intentional to let go of it all. Others say it was an accident. But whatever happened, whatever the intention was, the result was that they said, okay, what do we do now? And they became basket weavers. And they traveled around. They still went from monastery to monastery, teacher to teacher. And the way that they supported themselves was by making baskets and selling them in marketplaces. So they did let go. They did leave home. They let go of all of their worldly possessions. However, their way remained the same. They didn't need to become monks. It was a family. Right, there was children. There were two children, a father and a mother. So here's a story from Layman Pang, where layman Peng was lying on a couch reading a sutra. A monk happened to walk by. This was probably in a monastery, that we're assuming. A monk walked by and said, "Layman, you must maintain dignity when reading a sutra." The layman raised up one leg. The monk had nothing to say. That's the story. And all of these stories around layman Peng are similar like this, okay? So the monk is the monk is talking about decorum, about formality, about ritual, about what's appropriate and what's not. And we're very familiar with that, not only in our practice world, but in our daily lives. You're supposed to... of course, things have changed. I would say my mother's generation, a woman was supposed to get married as soon as possible, have children, many children, stay at home, raise the children. The father went off to work, brought home the money. The mother did the cooking, the cleaning, the raising the children, and the father went out and earned the money. And that was basically what was expected of my mother's generation. My generation was different, and your generation is different. We have other expectations, though. Our worldly world is full of things that we are... The decorum is we should do this, we should do that, we should be homeowners, we should have a new car. Usually has a lot to do with possessions, but not only. It's, you know, a university education, or not. You know, a different... according to your place... Even that, your place in the culture and the society has different assumptions about what is expected of you and what you should do, and the decorum of that. Even so, we took the airplane yesterday, and on these low-cost airlines, you know, you have to pay for everything, right? And if you want to take a bag on the plane, in the cabin, you have to pay for that, and it has to be exactly a certain size. If you want to take a bag and put it in the how do you say that?
Under
right. Everybody understands what I'm talking about. I can't think of the word in English. I know it in French. And then you have to pay more for that too. And if you bring a bag on the airplane, like a backpack, you have to put it under your seat. So, this is all very clear, and they repeat it over and over and over again, and they check you, whatever. So I've had experiences on that when I've not been allowed to put my backpack up in the hold, even if there is space, right? Because that's the rule. So I'm very well briefed on this, and I do what I'm supposed to do. And so I got on this plane yesterday, and many people were getting on the plane, and they were putting their backpacks in the little stow area above, and I thought, that's interesting. I thought that we weren't supposed to do that, so I'm stuck on the decorum, right? So I asked the woman, the flight attendant, about that. I said, can I put my backpack up there? There's space. There's plenty of space. She said, sure, go ahead. The decorum changed, or she was not attached to the decorum, and I was able to let go of my attachment to the decorum, and I put my backpack up there. It was fine. Another flight attendant might have come down the aisle. I saw that on an airplane once. Came down the airplane and told everyone who had put their bags up there they had to take them down, including me. And then there's a lot of fights about it and arguments. These are just examples of how we get... There are things we have to obey, rules, rituals, things like that in our lives that are necessary to follow and very practical. If everyone brought on huge suitcases on the airplane, it would be really complicated. So, of course, we understand this. However, what happens is we get caught and we get stuck on them. So the layman Peng is pointing us to, let's not get stuck on it, okay? And he's inviting the monk to, by saying, you know, just by lifting up his one leg, he's inviting the monk to step beyond the rules, even for 1 second, so that he can experience directly just what is. Oops. Postcard from a friend. Experience just directly without an idea of right and wrong and rules and whatever. What is it right now if we're not stuck on these rules? That you have to sit in a certain place, read the sutra in a certain way. It's interesting that he's reading a sutra, right? So he is involved in the way of awakening. He's not reading comic book, okay? In 9th century China, I don't know what they had, but there certainly were things that people read for relaxation, you know, the equivalent of a comic book, probably. But he wasn't. He was reading a sutra. Even that, so what is a sutra? A comic book could be a sutra. Very interesting, and I've said this recently, D.T. Suzuki, the great Japanese scholar who introduced a lot of Zen to the West, I read in one of his books that the translation of Kinhin, which is walking meditation, is sutras walking. So you are the sutra. The sutra is walking when we're doing this. Okay, we're doing this with the decorum of walking in a certain way. When we're diving in the swimming pool, we're also a sutra, and yet we don't experience it in the same way. Our attention is channeled when we're doing walking meditation, kinhin, so that allows us to have a more chance of an experience of the sutra walking. The sutras are just things that people wrote down that supposedly the Buddha said. We have to trust it because they were written down centuries after he died. But first they were memorized in the oral tradition. And that's even why they're structured in that way of like repetition, constantly repeating. Because that's how people remembered them. I have someone who I see in Dokusan online, and the way she remembers her koans, because sometimes they're long, you know, there's a lot of things. So I used to see her going like, she would like say something and she'd go like this, and then she'd say something else and she would go like this. Something else. So the way she was remembering it was the first line, the second line, the third line, fourth line, and like doing this. And I thought, that's really a good idea, you know, to remember, to have some technique to remember. So in the sutras, they have this technique of repeating over and over and over again, and then like question and answer and repeating, whatever. Just decorum to help us experience what is being expressed in the sutra. It's not that that's some official, of course it's become kind of doctrine, but it's not really. What's the deeper meaning of what's being said? Bernie Glassman used to say that if you chanted the Heart Sutra, if you really just chanted the first syllable, the A, it starts with Avalokiteshvara. So if you just really chant the A, you've chanted the whole sutra. The whole thing is right there. I mentioned, was it yesterday when I mentioned about chanting? Or maybe it was during the Samung today, I don't know. That's it. If you just give yourself entirely to the chant, without worrying about what it means even, throw yourself entirely into it. I once had an experience in a session in Poland where all the chanting was done in Polish, and I don't speak Polish. Big, big retreat, 100 people or something. And this was in the days when there were 3 ceremonies a day, and at the midday ceremony, we chanted the Heart Sutra. So I know the Heart Sutra in French, I know it in English, you know, we sometimes chant it in Japanese, but Polish, I didn't know, you know. And the woman who was doing the makugio, you know, the beating the drum, boom, 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 was like sitting right across from me. And she was flying. She was like in some kind of nirvana. I don't know where she was. But she was just completely doing it. And I didn't need to even know it was being said anymore. You know, I was with her. She was taking me, like, I was just one with her and then beating that drum. And she was chanting because she was Polish. If you throw yourself into it entirely, the decorum then, in fact, the decorum gets in the way of throwing ourselves into it entirely. No. I'm not sure. I keep using this word decorum. How would you say that? In French, would we use that same word?
Formality?
Maybe, formality? Yeah, maybe something like that. Yeah, you know, like a very formal
protocol?
Way of protocol. That's my kind of idea.
Maybe yeah. We can get it from the not decorum, indecorous.
And what would that mean? Like
not decorum.
Ah, okay. Not you use that word in Portuguese?
We use indecorous. It's the culture.
We have.
It's not appropriate.
We have decoros também. Decoros. Decoro.
Okay.
We have the same word. We don't use it.
You don't use it, but
yeah, it's too Polish.
It exists. Oh, is it? Yeah. Okay. Well, it is. It kind of has because it's like about posh, right?
Yeah, posh, yeah.
So it's talking about the word speaks for what it is. Yeah. And probably in our cultures when there was more decorum, it was used more. I don't know. It's not that there's not decorum now, it's just different decorum, let's say. So it's interesting that I'm using that word, which takes us out of our usual language and our usual ways of thinking to open us up and look at things differently, maybe, something like that. So Layman Pang was wonderful for this, and his wife and children as well, because they feature in many of the stories as well. And they all were practitioners, and they all had great awakenings at different moments, and had encounters with people, and in moments of like this, of just raising the leg. Which is very inspiring for us as lay people who, even in our Sangha, so Claudia was at a retreat last week in my original Sangha, where everyone wears black robes, right? More or less. Yeah. And that's a certain kind of decorum. I'm not saying it's good or bad, but it's just a different way of approaching it. We don't do that here. If someone wants to wear a black robe, I have no problem with that. And in that Sangha, in Dana, if someone doesn't want to wear a black robe, there's no problem with it. So it's not like a dictatorship where you have to look like this or you can't look like that, something like that. It's just a different set of decorum. The practice is the same. I trained in that Sangha and received transmission in that Sangha and still love all of my comrades and my teacher and still like to practice with them, but I took off those robes and did something else. I was able to, like Layman Pang, or like many of us in many situations in our life, let go of the decorum, not be stuck on it, not grasp to it. And see, okay, well, what is the deeper meaning there? What is this practice really about? And is that necessary to realize? Do we need to wear a certain piece of clothing to realize that? What the point of the practice is? Something like that. I know for me it was a very powerful thing to say, okay, I will no longer wear, you know, just ordinary clothing, and I will put on a robe. It was very powerful to let go. That was an act of letting go. Mm-hmm. And no longer choosing what I would wear. I didn't even have to think about it anymore. I didn't have to think about what I would pack when I went on retreat. It was very easy. It still is easy because it's a different set of decorum. Right? Mm-hmm. I have different clothing that I wear for retreats, and that's what I do. That's what I pack. And I know there was something liberating about not being anything special. Everybody's wearing the same thing. No specialty. However, what happens if some people get these really nice silk robes and other people have like blue kimonos underneath instead of white. Some people have belts around them. Others have really old, tattered robes. I mean, so there is like a difference. Everybody's not really still wearing the same thing. And then some people improvise and they have like a black dress that looks kind of like a robe and they wear that. you know, right, you could probably tell stories of it. But
there was a brown robe.
There was a brown robe this time?
Among the black robes, yeah.
And brown robes, so that's a different decorum. That's a different tradition where that, like, you know, Rory's...
I'm used to brown robes.
Exactly, yeah, because he's Rakus who's brown. So in that tradition, which is a Zen tradition as well, they wear brown. In the Korean Zen tradition, they wear gray, pale gray. At the Zen Mountain Monastery in New York, which is from is the White Plum lineage, they also wear gray, kind of like the color of Seu's rakusu, which was a robe.
Yeah,
she's supposed to have a black rakusu, but she just collected clothing from bits of cloth, and that was from someone's robe. So it's just different sets of decorum, different sets of forms, and can we not be attached to that? So this comes back to what I was saying about daily life and what we think of as practice. It's all practice, and it's all daily life. There are different things we do. I'm just looking because I read a story recently about from a Zen teacher from another lineage who said he met in a grand magasin, you know, a big department store, kind of like, well, maybe not exactly, but when I saw our Orioki bowls, I was thinking of that store in Lisbon, Pollux, or what is it?
Pollux,
yeah. You know? Where you have, oh, it's amazing, I walked around in that store. It's like each floor has, it's like, wow, I want that. All this kitchen stuff and the dish, it's amazing, that store. And that's where our Orioki bowls come from. I only know that because Juan told me that. And so, in a store kind of like that, say, the Zen teacher was buying something, I don't know, and he got to talking to the salesman who was there. And it turns out the salesman was a former Catholic monk. He had been a monk for 20 years and was now working in this store. And so the Zen teacher asked him about it, and he said, yeah, while I was in the monastery, my mother became ill and had no money and had no one to take care of her, and if I had stayed in the monastery, she probably would have ended up in the street. So I left the monastery, got a job, so that I could take care of her. And the Zen teacher said, he didn't quote the guy, but he said that the salesman felt that he had not left his way of his spiritual path by doing this. He was just doing something else, but that too was his way. Mm-hmm. And he made the choice. He didn't cling to the, you know, we have this idea, you have to leave home, you have to go away, you have to become a monk, live in a monastery. We think that would be really easy, right? It's not easy, but we think it would be. And then we wouldn't have to think about all of this. And here was an example of someone who gave that up, let go of that, to enter the worldly world. Because that's what was appropriate. That's what needed to be done. His calling was that. And for him, that was not different than his vocation serving Christ or entering a monastery, listening to God, or praying something like that. This too is an inspiring story of, okay, so, you know, this is someone who does the opposite. Well, first he left his worldly world, became a monk in a Catholic monastery, and then 20 years later leaves it to re-enter the stream of the worldly world. You know, often we say that in the Buddhist tradition it's about entering the stream. As soon as you awaken or you take the vows or you take refuge or something, you enter the stream of the Dharma. Well, the stream of the Dharma is everywhere. So every moment is an entering. If it is, but we don't always see it. So can we experience that as being an entering and not get caught on the decorum and the set ways that we think it should be? So like Layman Peng, reading a sutra on the sofa. Don't have to be in a specific place, time, setting, piece of clothing to read the sutra. You can serve your way and the way of the world anywhere. And the best place to do it is here, where you are, in your circumstances. And it will look different for everyone, and it will look different in each moment. Like we said, everything is passing. And the Buddha's basic teaching is that that's what causes us to suffer, is that we grasp to what's passing. We try to hang on to what's passing. And we suffer because of that. We struggle. We want things to be a certain way. We don't want them to be another way. And we miss the fact that everything is already here. We already have what we need right here and now. And this moment is where we need to be. Something like that. Right here in this circumstance. Now we have the famous story, so I'm talking about the Buddha. The famous awakening story of the Buddha is that he leaves his wife and child. And this story is told, and it has a happy ending because the wife and child come and practice too, and everything's good, right? It's a story, so it works out well, right? And then sometimes we take that to mean that it's okay to abandon your family to pursue what you want to do, something like that. It might be, you know, that might be the way. In fact, for the Buddha, that was the way. And we're sitting here now because of that. If we, you know, because karmically, everything that happened has led us to where we are right now. If one thing had not happened the way it did, we wouldn't be here. Whether it's the Buddha leaving his family or whether it's, I don't know, a plane crash somewhere in the Andes or whatever. It's, everything matters. Everything converges to make this moment happen. So we can say, okay, it's great that he did that because we're here now. But the point is actually, what's the deeper meaning of his act? And what's the deeper meaning of us repeating that story? Not clinging, maybe like the Catholic monk who's not clinging to his monastery life. The Buddha was not clinging to his comfortable palace, protected life. I'm certainly not going to, you know, enter into, well, yeah, so because he was not clinging to it, he left it. Whatever it is, the fact is that he acted in a way that was contrary to what was expected, right? And we can say that, I see that Seo gave me this. Is this like to, like,
yeah?
Yeah? Mm-hmm. I should have had the koan about the elephant fan, but I forgot. I didn't know I was going to have a fan, so. Maybe, maybe I'll do that one tomorrow.
You need it now.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I have like not a very nice one. This is a nice one at home, and I forgot it. So this is nice. So we just don't. How do we know if it's appropriate? Then what we're doing right. How do we know when? How do we? We can be caught by the expectations of our culture, right? Which I say, you know, as all of us, if we're sitting here today, we've already let go a bit of the expectations of our culture. Because, you know, most people in August on summer vacation, they don't come and sit on a Zen retreat. You know, there's not very many of us here, right? It's not the most popular thing to do. But popular doesn't mean right. You know, that's what we often say. One of the problems with democracy is that what the majority decides is not necessarily what's best, right? So what the majority out there is doing today is not necessarily what is appropriate. Well, it's certainly not what's appropriate for you because you're here, right? So can we, sometimes we can say, oh, I have to leave this worldly world and let go of my attachments to possessions and give everything away and move into a monastery or something, because we are resisting something in that worldly world that we don't want to look at. We're hanging on to some idea of what that world is about and how I fit into it or what my place is or something. So we throw it all away and go off and become a monk. Sometimes we don't pursue our spiritual way because we're attached to, oh no, this is not what is expected of me in this world. Spiritual stuff, that's flaky. You have to be grounded. You have to like move up the career ladder, read, you know, become an intellectual, whatever it is. So in wherever we are, what are we clinging to? You know, what are we grasping at? And our sense of this is practice and that's daily life is full of something we're hanging on to. Ideas about what is practice and what is daily life. My teacher's teacher used to say, the question isn't, am I stuck? The question is, where am I stuck? We're always stuck somewhere. So what is it we're stuck on? What am I clinging to? And it can be something, you know, as simple as when I go into the meditation hall, I have to wear a specific piece of clothing. You know, that can be one. Or it can be, I can't really fully practice because, you know, I have a family, and I can't be a Zen practitioner. I may as well not even engage with it. This is an extreme case, because all of us here, you know, we have families and jobs and a worldly life. So we know what it is to have a practice and to have a family life, even if you don't have children, however you think of as family life, friends, occupation, whatever. Can we not become stuck on those ideas of what that is? I was talking with my teacher just a few days ago, well, probably a week ago now, because before she left for her retreat, and she, in the house where she lives, it's a Zen center, where residents live there, and I helped build that center and was among the first residents with my family, as you know, and we stayed there for 6.5 years. And at that time, in those early years, there was like a waiting list for people who wanted to live in that house. And it was rivalry about who would be lucky enough to live there. And as soon as someone had the vaguest idea they would leave, someone else would ask to come, you know. And there was even one person who camped out in the basement waiting for the room upstairs to become available. And it ended up lasting like a year, camping out in the basement waiting for the other one to be free. And my teacher was, the room is empty there. There's a room empty there. No one wants to come and live there. And...
Sorry? You mean now?
Yeah. Yeah. You thinking of moving there?
No.
Right. Yeah, just kidding.
That's my mind, but...
Yeah, you know? And it's empty. And no one wants to come and live there. And so there's this question of, well, there's a lot of explanations why. But there's always... There's also... Why? You know, what there, she knows there's a number of explanations. The Sangha has grown older. People have become more established in their lives. There aren't so many young people who are free enough to just drop everything and come and live there. But really, what is the deeper meaning of that? Why does nobody want to come and live there? And if she doesn't have people living in that house, she can't really stay in that house. Because she needs the revenue, the you know, income, and she needs people to help. She has a great successor who's living there and who runs much of the operation, but you need other people there too. Actually, there's two people living there. Someone is living in the basement, and he helps a lot. But you know, he's not officially one of her students, so it's different. So things change. Right? And so what do we do? How do we then adjust to the current situations? How do we instill this this burning desire for this practice and to engage our whole life fully with it, which in the early, you know, 30 years ago when we created that center, that's what it was. All of us were just burning desire to integrate daily life and practice and to be there and to live with our teacher and to share this experience of community in that way, you know. I guess it's different now in that Sangha. It's not the same thing. If, you know, by some magic circumstance, our Sangha had some situation like that, I don't know, maybe there wouldn't be anyone who would want to come and live there. I don't know, you know? We don't know, because that's not the circumstances of our Sangha. That Sangha, for 30 years, they've had a Zen center where people come and practice and do retreats, even if they don't live there. I tried for 3 years in Paris to have a center, and I just, no. It's not my way. According to the circumstances of my life, my practice, my Sangha, you know, it just wasn't it. And my teacher even said to me towards in the last year of that when we were, I didn't really know what to do. I felt that it wasn't right anymore, but I didn't want to abandon it. And my teacher just said, you know, well, maybe you don't have a Sangha that needs that or wants that. And she was right. Our Sangha is very different. Organically, it has grown differently. So can we not be caught on what the expectations are? Oh, you should have a center. Oh, you should do it this way. There is no one way. The one way is your way. And if we get stuck on how we think it should be, then we don't pay attention to what it is, you know, to what our true way is, actually. And you know, you may sit here and listen to this talk and think, "Oh, then, yeah, no, this isn't my way," you know. And then you go find another teacher, you know, in another way or something. But there's similarities in all the ways, for all of our paths. Another one of the stories from the Buddha, which is interesting, was the where Ananda says to him, I something like, so I understand that half of the path, half of the practice is good spiritual companionship, good spiritual friendship, and good spiritual camaraderie or community or something like that. And friendship, camaraderie, and community, I think it is. And the Buddha then says, no, Ananda, that's not it. The whole practice is good spiritual friendship, good spiritual companionship, and good spiritual community. Beautiful, right? Mm. And that, you know, a true spiritual community will reflect that. Whether they wear robes, whether they don't, whether they talk about the Buddha, whether they talk about Christ, whether they talk about Allah, whatever it is, they will reflect that. The good spiritual friendship, camaraderie, and community in different ways. You know, if you have these huge mega churches, I don't know how well that, you know, in mega church in the U.S., it's this thing where it's these thousands of people who come to the sermon on Sunday, and, you know, they have like music and show and the whole thing. I don't know what kind of spiritual friendship and camaraderie and community there is there. There may well be. I don't know. It does, but I'm saying it doesn't have to be a small thing where we know everybody. But it's in the relationships with one another, and then the way that the community functions around those individual relationships with one another, and how we cultivate the camaraderie around that, that reflects the true spiritual way of awakening to the true nature of being, something like that. However, if we get caught on the decorum, you know, maybe those big mega churches, they're caught on the decorum of you know, the form of it. I don't know. I've never been in one of those mega churches, but you see them on television. And, in my work with Buddhist leaders and the respecting boundaries and power abuse and misuse and this kind of thing, we often hear stories about different traditions where there's abusive situations, and sometimes it happens in those mega churches. Power abuse and sexual harassment and sexual abuse. And it's really hard to regulate in a big thing like that, because there isn't this link of spiritual community and friendship and camaraderie. Of course, those things happen in Buddhist communities as well. It's not just mega churches. Because it's human.
And at the same time, we can be a friend to everyone, to every human being.
Absolutely. Yep. Absolutely. And that's where we see our true practice. Yeah. Absolutely. That we, and so true spiritual friendship is not just in the community, you know. And when we say true spiritual friendship, it's not necessarily talking about Zen practice or spiritual practice. Because when we see that I and the other are not separate, then we can truly, truly speak to the other in a spiritual way, even though that's, you know, it can be a colleague at work and you're not talking about anything, what we think of it. So do not get caught on the decorum of what's spiritual and not. All right? Or a neighbor, you know. Or someone we don't even know. You know,
the cat. Or a cat or a dog.
Exactly, a cat or a dog. Exactly. Yeah. Whatever it is, whatever we interact with, can we interact from that place of oneness and appreciation and respect and love, actually, because ultimately it's love that it is. Yeah, are there any questions or comments or anyone want to add anything?
I want to ask a comment. What I feel from this teaching is a lot about getting out of the decorum, like being free from the decorum. And in my life as a daughter, I was always breaking the rules and everything. And as an educator, I'm needing to hold on to the rules again, so getting into the formality. And it's a very, very different, it's a very difficult balance, what to do and what you said about looking up at what you get stuck. I think it's a great teaching. It's very difficult sometimes to understand what because I get also a lot of conflict, the fact that I create rules. So now I get the how do you say, the conflict from creating rules and wanting to the son to break these rules. So I'm in between which kind of formality is really right.
Mm. Mm.
That's the. It's always this middle.
The middle way.
Way,
yeah.
That it's difficult to. But it's just interesting to understand. I was not fully aware, but it's how I'm returning to formality as a need to educate, but how much should we apply?
Absolutely, you know, good point. Because it's not so much being caught, you know, rejecting the decorum or not. It's like not hanging on to our ideas about the decorum, and because then we get into, well, right and wrong, and we're not able to then just respond freely to the situation. This is what's needed in this moment. I don't know if as an educator you're talking professionally or as a parent.
As
or,
a parent.
Yeah. So, and I thought so. So that's what, as a parent, we're constantly called upon to, okay, well, what is necessary in this moment? Mm-hmm. And what does this child need to know? Because he needs to grow, or she, or to learn. And yeah, absolutely. It's not, there's no set response. It's fluid, like you say.
Mm-hmm.
It requires us to really stay present to ourselves and pay attention to, okay, so yeah, am I just like, say, like my daughter the other day was telling her 6-month-old son, who my grandson, who is like teething and constantly putting his fingers in his mouth, and then he puts them so far back in his mouth that he gags and throws up, you know. Not every time, but it's kind of, babies do this kind of thing. So she's trying to keep telling him, no, don't put your fingers in your mouth, you know. And it's not so much that she doesn't want him to put his fingers in her mouth. She doesn't really care if he puts, she knows why he's doing it. But it's that she doesn't want him to gag and throw up. So it's coming from this place of not, you shouldn't put your fingers in your mouth. It's coming from this place of, oh, you know, you're going to hurt yourself and lose your bottle that you just drank if you do it, you know. And as children get older, we know that, you know, we want them to be safe and understand how the world works and where is it coming from when we're setting these boundaries, yeah. Yeah.
This is like...
Yeah, really. Interesting. But it's true, every August when we come here or anywhere in Portugal, we hear this. Yeah.
Also, just a comment, but when you're saying about the drum, that the person who was drumming was really on it, it's interesting how, because I'm starting to drum as a practice as well, and it's incredible how the drum actually shifts our consciousness, so we get into kind of this complete... present of them, being totally present at the moment. So I think this is the experience, because it prompts us.
And is it for you, is it because it's like direct and
it's the same rhythm.
Yeah.
It's like
It's not the same.
No, but yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And certain things are more conducive to that, and yet anything is possible with anything. Mm. Absolutely. And it's important when we have an experience like that, we feel that, then we can say, oh yeah, you know, that's what this is. And can I... Oh, yeah. That's the final one?
Yes.
I don't know. There's three.
Time to lunch.
Oh, is that what that is?
I don't know, but it's the time where every Portuguese say
it has to be loud.
It's loud, yeah. But I think some of this is kind of getting off the subject, but someone told me about this that there's like the head guy in the village or someone is the one who has the privilege of firing it. Or something like that, and that often like their hands have been blown off and things like that. Did you tell me that?
I think historically it was like that, and I've met people with no fear.
Yeah, that's maybe you're the one who told me that.
Not actually true. But historically it was warned the nearby villagers that there was a fight.
Another ritual, another decorum, you know?
I'm struggling to think of a word, but there is one on my mind. I think it's preliminary, maybe, or there's probably one a bit better than that, but it's like when rules are there for now, you know, they're not there so that they're always there because that's the perfect way to do it. They're there, a bit like with kids, you put in kind of preliminary, vague versions of a rule until they're old enough to understand why we do those things. At first, it's just don't put your hands in your mouth. Later, it's, of course, you can put your hands in your mouth occasionally, just don't choke yourself on purpose, you know. Okay, in this case, you can choke yourself on purpose, but, like, you know, whatever, you know, everything's preliminary. It's just like, here's the best version of it I can formulate for now until you meet the moment where that's not relevant either. Or, and I think with these kind of practices, you meet them all the time. You end up at a point where you say, but I thought that was the rule, and now I see someone clearly doing the opposite. And that's the right thing to do in that moment, you know. So it's like everything's just there for now, you know, temporary, really. It's like,
absolutely.
It's not fixed.
It's not fixed, but the structure has to be present all the time, otherwise it's you lose yourself completely.
Well, and there's always structure. Even when we think there isn't, there is, you know, so... Yeah, but it's impermanent, like everything. And can we then be fluid and, you know, coming back to, well, what's the right thing, the right response in any given moment, whether it's about decorum or about what to eat or, you know.
Mm-hmm. I have a beautiful story that it's very to share with you all. It's was a teenager. He was living with me. He was not used to our rules of eating at the table. It was a different thing. One day I told, please, he was eating, and I said, please, can you just put your hand up? What I was mean, it was to don't cling in the table eating like this. And he just put, when I said, can you put your hand? And I'm so happy doing that. Yes. And I was completely delighted on that. Okay. Yeah, and I didn't say, and I explained what I was right. Mean. Yeah. It was so useful.
Very free.
So
yeah.
Free.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, can we be free to... I'm thinking of a story my teacher used to tell of when Maizumi Roshi, who was her teacher's teacher, was in Europe. He only came twice, I think. She wanted him to meet her mother. Her mother was this very Catholic woman, very bourgeois, wealthy family. This whole thing of Zen that she was doing was, everybody disapproved of it. But I think maybe it was Maizumi Roshi who wanted to meet her mother. I think it was that way. So they arranged a dinner at this really nice restaurant in Paris. And the men had to wear ties and jackets. This was old days in Paris. And Maizumi Roshi put on a suit and a tie. He was used to eating at a low table, you know, eating like Oreoki type food and things and wearing his kimono and whatever. But he did it. He put on his suit and a tie. And they went to this restaurant. And he was apparently absolutely charming. He knew exactly what to, how, which fork to use and which glass to drink out of, and enjoyed the meal and was just charming and talked with her mother the whole time. I forget what they talked about. Mm-hmm. Something that they could both relate to. I don't know what it was, but and it was a success, you know. Maizumi Roshi was able to let go of, oh, this is how we eat, this is how I should meet her, she should, you know, I need to show her what this Zen thing is. Tiago was calling you. But he didn't. He said, oh, well, for him, the Zen thing was meeting people where they are. So he meets her, this woman, where she is and the kind of place she likes to eat and what she eats and how she dresses. And he took over, he went into her decorum, her world of decorum, instead of making her come into his. Is it time for lunch?
Yeah.
Okay.
Rome be Roman.
Yeah. In Rome, do as the Romans do, as we say, yeah. Exactly, yeah. Again, very deep teaching. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I made a lot of copies to a lot of dynamics of healing and therapies come from that teaching. Many approach.
Yeah. Of responding to the situation? Or what?
Yes, to teach people to behave. Yes.
Oh, right. Yeah, of course. Behavioral thing. Yeah.
So meet the other where the other is.
But I have a because for me to be in Rome, be Roman, it doesn't feel right. My heart, for me, I could give an example that as my mother, she's French, and I was brought up eating with one fork and bread instead of a knife, whereas in Portugal you eat with a knife and fork. So it makes me question, how do you bring your lineage? You know, if you take the extreme, you know, in Morocco, eating a chicken with my bare hands and pulling it out, which I did. If I was Moroccan and wanted to carry on the lineage of my ancestors and the way they ate, and then I married someone who was used to eating with their pinkies up and eating with a fork the other way around, you know, then am I neglecting my inheritance because of where I live and everything I can pass on to my children, you know, and these, or do you just let go and sometimes you eat with your hands and sometimes you don't, you know, you find a new way, so you're not being Roman in Rome, you're creating your own family way. Of doing, and then you're creating your own pattern.
No, I hear what you're saying. And it comes back to not being having the freedom to do what you feel is appropriate, you know, and not being stuck on. Well, so even the, you know, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. You know, I experience that as more kind of like what we call seasonal eating. So when it's summertime, you eat summer vegetables, and when it's wintertime, you eat winter vegetables, that kind of thing. You try to stay in touch with what is the circumstances. And if it seems appropriate to eat with your hand, I've been to Morocco and I did not eat with my hands. Sometimes what?
And I eat with my hands, and
Right.
Especially during my childhood in Africa, I would sneak out to eat with people that live there with my hands. And even now, when I'm alone, I eat everything with my hands.
Right. So can we have the freedom to? I guess maybe what you were saying, Albin, it's like sometimes yes and sometimes no, and you don't have to let go of how you like to eat or how what you think is appropriate just because somebody else thinks it's not appropriate, you know. Mm-hmm. And can you have the freedom to, okay, well, in this circumstance, maybe it is appropriate to do their way, like Maizumi Roshi did. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's not, you know. Sometimes why not eat with a bread and a fork or whatever it is? Yeah, I mean, the French lots of cultures, it's unacceptable, but the French, you take a piece of bread and you clean off your plate with it. You know, you scrape everything up with the piece of bread. I don't know, in Portugal, do you do that?
No.
Yeah, but not in
nowadays. No, but in France, that's very acceptable, right?
Not in France either.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, it depends, but, you know, it's kind of a general thing that's acceptable.
This is an interesting thing. Coming back to formalities, because this is one of our discussions at table. Like, what do we teach to our children? So there's this two ways and two ways of seeing,
right?
And what is appropriate? So it's not an easy, and this is just a metaphor for many other things.
There is also different ways to eat with your hands. With your hands and not being messy and being very elegant.
Yeah.
And you can eat with a fork and be...
Absolutely. Mm. Yep. Absolutely. And so there's no set rule. So let's come back to like the very beginning of this. So what is practice and what is daily life? So sitting at the table eating is practice, right? So how do we approach it from this practice point of view of appreciation, seeing things as they truly are, respecting the places? That's what Orioki is fantastic. None of us eat like this at home, right? We don't eat with three bowls. And what?
I try to put my kids eating like that. It's so simple.
And did they like it? Or?
No.
Right.
Well, Joaquin would love to have Orioki every day.
Oh, yeah,
this is like his highlight.
So, you know, it's just one form of eating, and then you go to another country and it's a different form and whatever. Orioki is structured so that it brings us our attention back all the time to what we're doing. Hopefully, that's the intention. Sometimes we forget and we put the wrong thing and we put the spoon in the other bowl or whatever it is. But the intention is to bring us back to have, you know, enlightened eating or something, we could say. Awakened eating. So we're really paying attention. However, if we get stuck on the decorum, if we're really like fixated on what we're supposed to be doing and that person's not doing it right and whatever, then we're not really appreciating the food. Mm-hmm. We're no longer fully present. So that's when the decorum gets in the way. And yet it's important to have some kind of decorum. Otherwise, we'll...
Have the information, many possibilities, and you use the opportunity to enjoy this situation, also to change and to enjoy and
pleasure,
and to have pleasure with that, and to give pleasure to the mother. And it's in this scene that I heard in Rome, dear Roman. It's in this scene, not like, but be together.
And be aware of your circumstances, the people, what the Romans are doing, who they are. Yeah, yeah. Well, and
finding the freedom within it.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Just a final story about Maizumi Roshi. When he was interviewed on a television program in the U.S. with other spiritual leaders of something, I don't know what the occasion was, and they asked each one of them what is important in their tradition or something. And when it got to him, he said, everything is important. That's, you know, wow, can we really take that on? Everything is important. Very simple, and yet very deep and wide. Wow. Subtle as well. So as we started out with, you know, infinitely subtle, this teaching, everything is important. And as soon as we start saying, oh, well, this is important, but that's not, this is my practice of awakening, this is my way of awakening, and this is not, then we start, then we've created, you know, oceans and continents of separation. Just with one tiny little hair of this is important and this is not, everything's split. All the dualities are opened. What time is it? Okay, so we should probably end there. Thank you. Let's chant the vows. Yeah.